I'm going to talk about the history of the stance that most Australian churches took to warfare and Australia's involvement in wars and that have been mostly fought in other people's countries. And I believe it's not a history to be proud of. Contrary to Jesus' teachings that his followers should be peacemakers and not return evil for evil, throughout the 20th century, the mainstream churches fell in with jingoistic and militaristic spirit of the times and apparently never questioned their support of violence and killing. One church has taken a different route, and that is the Society of Friends, and known as the Quakers. So too have a few sects, such as the Christadelphians and the Jehovah's Witnesses. The Seventh-day Adventists permitted their members to enlist as non-combatants or soldiers who were not involved in fighting. That's what I'm going to talk about. I want to start with the colonial era because it sets the scene for attitudes to war. Fear of attack by hostile power was ever present in the Australian colonies in the 19th century. Hostile powers included France, Germany, Russia, the USA, China, Holland, Japan, and Spain. By the end of the century, Japan's emergence as a militaristic imperial power put it at the top of the list of most feared powers. Britain maintained military forces in Australia until 1870. After that, the colonies were left pretty much on their own to protect themselves, and each colony raised a volunteer force, which probably would have been totally hopeless had a war come to mainland Australia. Debates in the colonial parliaments included questions such as should the colonies acquire their own navy, or should they rely on the British to send a gunboat still, which is what they'd been doing before. Distance from both Britain and between the colonies themselves increased the fear. But contrary to this, a tradition of protest against involvement in other nations' wars developed. As early as the 1850s, the Reverend John Dunmore Lang, a Presbyterian minister, argued in a series of public lectures that the British Navy and the British Empire were a danger to Australia's security. Australia's allegiance to the Empire made Britain's enemies Australia's enemies. It's the same argument that has been used against the USA in more recent times for those who follow that kind of debate. If you're allied to a major power that makes enemies all around the world, as the United States of America has done, you're likely to be in the firing line. The first Australian soldiers to fight in an overseas war were in New South Wales colonial troops who fought in the unpopular Sudan campaign of 1885. It was mounted to avenge the death of the British General Gordon at the hands of the Mahdi's forces, and of course the Mahdi was fighting to clear his own country of British imperialists. Although many in Australia opposed sending troops, this action set an unfortunate precedent. Henceforth, Australian governments would unquestioningly offer troops to wars that did not endanger Australia, and most had the equally unquestioning support of the churches. I don't know how well you can read this in this cartoon from the Bulletin, which was an anti-war cartoon, but it's the idea that you're throwing soldiers to the god of, to Moloch, the dreadful god that took child sacrifices. The South African or Boer War was the first war that the federated Australian nation was involved in. The war began in 1898 and ended in 1902. Prior to federation, each colony sent soldiers to the war. After federation, one of the first pieces of legislation passed in the Commonwealth Parliament in 1901 was a bill to send an Australian force to the war. Another one was the White Australia Act, the Immigration Restriction Act. So two of the first three pieces of legislation passed in Australian Parliament, one to send soldiers to someone else's war and the other to stop people coming into the country who were regarded as undesirable aliens. Now, the leaders of the anti-war league against the Boer War were not church leaders. They included the Labour politician Holman, who later supported conscription in World War I, Sydney University professor George Wood, who nearly lost his job over his anti-war stance, and James Edmund, the editor of the Bulletin and person responsible for publishing this anti-war cartoon. After the war ended, the federal government introduced a new scheme for protecting Australia, conscripting 14-year-old boys. and training them for military service so that when the next war came, and it was always going to be a next war, that was inevitable the way people thought in those days, Australia would have a ready-trained army. Those who refused to be conscripted faced fines and imprisonment in military or civilian prisons. Now, between 1911 and 1915, the weekly average of prosecutions of boys who failed to attend drills ranged from 100 to over 300. That's every week around Australia. Between January 1912 and March 1915, over 7,000 boys were sent to prison. And they weren't all conscientious objectors. They may have been working boys who didn't make it to drills. They were taken up in batches and were supposed to defend themselves. And got a prison record for not going attending drills. One church stood out against this iniquitous system, the Quakers. At the 1910 general meeting, the Quakers resolved that if the compulsory training proposals became law, their denomination would be, quote, bound by our Christian conscience to refuse to yield them obedience. Led by John Hills, the South Australian Quakers organised some meetings to test public opinion on conscription and found enough support to launch the Australian Freedom League. Leagues were frequently formed in every state, except Western Australia. This possibly was because there were actually virtually no Quakers in Western Australia until the 1930s. By the beginning of World War I, in August 1914, there were 55,000 Freedom League members around Australia. The League's sole aim was to remove the compulsory service clauses from the Defence Act. It was concerned that the scheme that John Hills labelled boy conscription or child conscription, our country's shame, as he named a booklet that he put out at the time, would lead to the militarising of the whole nation. Quakers also feared among founders of the branches, also featured among founders of the branches of the London Peace Society in New South Wales and Victoria, where it was called the Melbourne Peace Society. The Reverend Charles Strong, a former Presbyterian minister who led an independent church in Melbourne, was president. These societies endured long after the boy conscription scheme had ceased. They fought other battles against conscription in the 1950s and the 1960s. Someone got jailed for that cartoon, which is extremely complex, and I won't try to explain it to you now. And they were a member of the industrial workers of the world and had no religious beliefs whatsoever. So when Britain declared war on Germany in August 1914, the mainstream churches quickly nailed their colours to the mast, to use a military metaphor, or naval, I should say. In the morning of the 16th of August 1914, Canon Robert Moore, preaching in St. John's Church in Fremantle, stated that it was, quote, ever God's plan to call nations and individuals to bear witness for him. There is no question about this tremendous vocation of our empire. There can be little doubt of our shortcomings. Is this, meaning the war, to be the fire of purification or the fire of destruction? And in the evening he had a similar message. Is it to be peace at any price so we suffer no loss? Or is it honourable peace that no matter what it cost, it will have made the world better by vindicating honour and justice and truth and opening the way for further evangelisation? Easy words for a man who was not going to risk his life under fire, although he did volunteer to serve as a padre on the Western Front. Moore's conservative theology was echoed in other Protestant churches. Even the Catholic priests, while not so wholeheartedly pro-empire, urged their parishioners not to shirk, but to play their part in defending the empire. See that metaphor of the game, you know, play up and play the game like it was a cricket match or something. In the early stages of the war, some of the peace organisations were disappointingly quiet. They seemed to accept the rhetoric that sacrifice was necessary. Charles Strong and some others remained implacably opposed, but they faced steep opposition because it could be argued that unlike the South African War, Australia was under threat from German military aggression. At that time, northeastern New Guinea was actually a German colony. The spark that revived anti-war resistance was Labour Prime Minister Billy Hughes' attempt to introduce conscription for overseas military service. The Australian Imperial Force, or AIF, was always a volunteer force, a citizen army, while other parts of the empire, notably Britain, Canada and New Zealand, legislated to conscript soldiers for overseas service. Hughes demurred. Although supporting compulsory military training, the ALP had always at least publicly opposed conscription for overseas service. So Hughes went to the people for a vote. Two plebiscites in October 1916 and December 1917 rejected the proposal narrowly. WA voted for it on both occasions. 70% in favour the first time, 65% the second. A revitalised Australian Freedom League campaigned strongly against the yes vote in both campaigns. Christian ministers and theological students could claim exemption from conscription. So could only sons or sons whose brothers were already enlisted. The exemption of only sons placed an unfair burden on large working class and often Catholic families. The law also failed to recognise ministers in sects such as Jehovah's Witnesses, some branches of the Brethren, or the Christadelphians, the Brothers of Christ. Independent ministers Charles Strong and Frederick Sinclair both spoke out strongly against the war, a stance that cost Strong many followers. So even though he was in an independent church that had cut loose from a denomination, they still didn't support him in his anti-conscription sermons. The Lutherans were the most mainstream denomination to strongly oppose conscription, not vocally, but with a solid no vote in the 1916 plebiscite. This, of course, led to charges of pro-Germanism and disloyalty and to some Australians of German origin losing the right to vote in the second plebiscite in 1917. None of the mainstream denominations was prepared to speak out against the war itself, but some church leaders objected to conscription for active service. In 1916, nine Protestant ministers addressed a manifesto on conscription and Christianity to, quote, the electors of Australia. They acknowledged they were a minority within their churches, which almost unanimously supported the principle of conscription. Courageously, they attacked, quote, ministers of the Prince of Peace, advocating often with intemperate zeal the subordination of the rights of individual conscience to alleged military necessity. And note the alleged there, the alleged military necessity. So even in World War I, people still looked at that and said, well, actually, maybe we don't need as many soldiers as we're claiming we do. Prominent anti-conscriptionists were the Catholic Archbishop Daniel Mannix in Melbourne and Congregational Minister the Reverend Albert Rivette. While Rivette was a more active campaigner, Mannix drew the attention of the media more because it was easy to cast him as a disloyal Irish Catholic, well, which he was, of course. After the war, compulsory military training continued in a scale-back form until the Labour victory in 1929 saw it suspended. Okay, so to World War II, when Britain declared war on Germany on the 3rd of December, September 1939, the Australian Prime Minister, Robert Menzies, instantly committed Australia to the war without even recalling Parliament. You know, the melancholy duty speech, for those of you who are historians. Within weeks, the government had enacted national security laws that gave it sweeping wartime powers, including reintroducing conscription for all males aged 18 to 60 years. Initially, there were very few categories for conscientious objectors, mainly, again, clergy and theological students, and there was no right of appeal until 1943. Jehovah's Witnesses were not only not recognised as clergy, but they were an outlawed association, just the same as the communists were, because they were regarded as subversive, and that didn't change until 1943. My research indicates that the numbers of objectors were small, perhaps 5,000 applying for exemption, compared with almost a million men and women in uniform by the end of the war. Those refusing to comply were imprisoned, not just once, but many times. And one of my sample of objectors was imprisoned five times for the same offence, refusing to enlist, refusing to attend a medical. The sentence was usually either 3 or 6 months' duration. He was a hardened criminal, they said, by the end of it. His name was Bill Tarry, and he ended up in Goulburn Jail. Started off when he was 18 years of age. The church's position on the war, Jehovah's Witnesses and Christadelphians were prominent among the objectors. When objectors from mainstream denominations applied for exemption from military service, they were often told they didn't have a case because their church didn't oppose the war or military service. The church's position on the war were much more complex than being in favour of it, as some magistrates claimed. The Presbyterian General Assembly of Australia supported freedom of conscience. stating that military service was a matter of individual conscience, not for the church to dictate. The Presbyterian and Methodist churches were both divided on the issue of pacifism. Some Methodist clergy wanted to establish a Methodist peace fellowship similar to an existing organisation in Britain, but others condemned the idea. There was similar conflict in the Churches of Christ. After the church in Victoria passed a resolution in 1940 supporting conscientious objectors, a member of the church wrote to the Prime Minister complaining that the resolution did not accurately reflect, quote, the attitude of 12,889 members in Victoria. It was, he claimed, moved by L.O. Collier, a notorious pacifist who honours neither national flag nor anthem. Now, the Reverend Collier was indeed a notorious pacifist. He'd been a conscientious objector in Britain during World War One, and that required a lot more grit than it had here in World War One, because they were conscripted and they were sent to prison and they were sometimes sent to the Western Front. He immigrated to Australia in the 1920s. During World War II, he became chair of the Melbourne Conscientious Objectors Group. How notorious can you get? The Anglican Church did not suffer such divisions, but certain individuals stood out against the war. Frank Coldrake, a theological student in Melbourne when the war began, earned his church's censure when he took part in a 1940 protest against the national security regulations. The Anglican Archbishop took the stance that going to war was a Christian's loyal duty and was concerned that Coldrake might, quote, spread his pacifist views to other theological students. The Archbishop told Coldrake that if you were seeking ordination, I probably would not be able to ordain you. We only have Coldrake's account of this, but apparently his parting shot was that by then he hoped the Archbishop would have seen that there is more truth and value in what I say than you will now admit. Courageous words indeed from a theological student to his Archbishop. Coldrake estimated that there were only about 20 pacifist Anglican clergy in the whole of Australia, and one of these was the Reverend E.E.V. Collicott, who also was prominent in opposing conscription. Not the war necessarily, but opposing conscription. Undaunted, Coldrake founded the pacifist newspaper Peacemaker, a four-page broadsheet that presented an alternative view during the war, and indeed outlived that conflict and several others, ceasing publication only in 1971. The Archbishop's threat was not realised. After the war, Coldrake, now an ordained Anglican priest, served as a missionary in Japan and later as chair of the Australian Board of Missions. He was actually elected Archbishop of Brisbane in 1970, but he died before he could take up the appointment. Very interesting man. I've put up here one of my favourite cartoons. It's by Norman Lindsay, who did a lot of pro-conscription cartoons in World War One, and I don't particularly like a lot of those, but this is after the dropping of the atomic bomb, and the goddess Nemesis is standing there with her hand on the bomb and looking down at this little professor saying, "Little man, what now?" Yeah. So the Cold War, and I realise we're getting close to time. Although compulsory military service lapsed at the end of World War II, the second Menzies government reintroduced national service during the Korean War. This scheme lasted for the whole of the 1950s. There was no intention to send conscripted national service trainees to fight overseas. That, of course, changed after the scheme was reintroduced for a third time just prior to Australia committing active service personnel to the Vietnam War. As in previous wars and periods of conscription, mainstream churches were acquiescent and protest was left to individual church members as well as the non-churched. A number of peace groups formed or reformed around Australia, often led by those who'd made a stand during World War II. Again, most Christian opposition came from the Quakers and such sects as the Christadelphians and Jehovah's Witnesses. Despite being known as a peace church, Quakers were not spared the act. This was exemplified by the case of a young Perth man called Ronald Waddy. He denied the right of appeal when his application for exemption was rejected. Waddy was arrested and imprisoned in a military detention centre. Opposition led to some interesting alliances. In South Australia, the Quakers, the Women's Peace Crusade, and the Communist Party of Australia united in protest against the arrest and military detention of another Quaker, Brian Mason. The Australian Council of the World Council of Churches also protested to the government about the lack of provision for appeal. The Church of Christ asked for exemption for all of its members, but didn't question the national service scheme or conscription. The Seventh-day Adventists maintained their embargo on active service while being prepared to serve in a non-combatant capacity. A little ha-ha for you there. It's actually New Zealand, a poster I was surprised to find. So the Vietnam War. After the National Service Scheme was reintroduced in 1964, the situation quickly became more complex, with the government committing active service personnel to the war in Vietnam and then announcing that conscripts would be included. Initially, a majority of Australians supported the war effort, believing that we should stand beside our ally, the United States, but there was always disquiet about the use of conscripts. And the polls show that there was never majority support for conscripts being sent to Vietnam, even when there was 62% support for us actually being involved in the war. The churches maintained their ambivalence, with most mainstream denominations supporting the war effort, and some prominent individuals breaking ranks to speak out against it. Many of these were involved in the peace organisations that I mentioned previously. The Quakers, quote, greatly regretted that the government believed it was necessary to compel young men to undertake military training and to allocate £404 million for armaments. The Quakers argued that combat training, quote, instills habits of violence and inculcates wrong values. Military training, they said, was an unethical substitute for real diplomacy, and I still believe that. Tolerance and negotiation, as it constituted preparation for war. On the 26th of May 1965, Frank Coldrake, now a canon in the Anglican Church, joined with other Christians, communists, members of peace groups and unionists in a protest outside Parliament House in Canberra. Christians were also among the members of Save Our Sons, an almost exclusively female protest group that organised silent vigils outside recruiting offices. Even some of them ended up in jail for trespassing on military property in Melbourne, who served them. 3 weeks, I think, in a women's prison. Unlike in previous wars, however, the Anglican Church was divided. Bishop J.S. Moyes insisted that the Vietnam War could never be termed just because it was a war of aggression instigated by the CIA, and the Archbishop of Perth regretted the government's decision to send troops. But three Sydney bishops thought the government should be trusted to make the right decisions, even when these affected the lives of thousands of young Australians as yet unable to vote. They believed Christian men should do their duty to the government and God by registering to be conscripted. Even the Catholic Church was divided by the war. Two Catholic newspapers in Victoria spoke out against conscription, leaving some readers astounded and disgusted. The Bishop of Bendigo claimed that the war in Vietnam was a holy war against communism. Therefore, he believed that conscription was justified. In March 1966, the Commission on Peace of the Methodist Church of Victoria and Tasmania opposed the government's decision to send conscripts to Vietnam. In May, the Victorian Congregational Church Union similarly opposed the use of chants in selecting national servicemen, as you can see, just like the lotto balls. And the principle of sending conscripts to fight overseas unless they volunteered for active service. By 1967, both the Presbyterians and the Methodists indicated the growing concern among their congregations about the conduct of the war. Jehovah's Witnesses were numerous among those seeking exemptions from military service, as before the Seventh-day Adventists were prepared to serve in non-combatant roles, which meant they wouldn't be sent to Vietnam. Well, they wouldn't be. Two major differences between conscription during the Vietnam War and earlier were the length of the sentence for those refusing to comply, 2 years initially, same period as their training, shortened to 18 months later on, and the numbers of people opposing involvement in this particular war rather than for pacifist reasons, that is to say they weren't anti-war per se, they were anti the Vietnam War. These compliers, as they became known, refused to register, to attend medical examinations, to go to court when summoned, or pay fines. Some presented themselves for arrest. Others went underground. Last pages. So, for those connected to a church who chose to make a stand, the fight could be very lonely, and I've included here some quotes from my recent research. Ken Mansell recalled, quote, "There seemed to be no one, least of all my parents or the church, I could turn to for advice or sympathy." When Paul McKeach applied to be exempted as a conscientious objector, the leaders of the Maylands Baptist Church where he was a member, refused to provide a character reference to the court. But Glenn Brooks came to his aid. Yes, good man, Glenn. And Ken Beale experienced a similar lack of support from his church. That was also in Western Australia. I think that was in Kalgoorlie. Graham Mowbray contrasted the difference between Christ's teaching on non-violence and the church's attitude to war. But, he wrote, the spirit of Christ is not changeable. The call is still to non-violence in all our dealings. When anti-war protesters staged a silent vigil in his church on Good Friday 1969, Archbishop Lone in Sydney asked the police officers, whom church wardens had called to arrest the protesters, to leave. He said, gentlemen, there is no reason for you to be here. After the service, the Archbishop spoke with the protesters, although he refused to engage in discussion about the war. So to summarise, the church responses to the Vietnam War were more varied and generally more negative than in previous wars, but the issue was clouded by the introduction of conscription for overseas service, as we saw in World War I, where churches opposed to conscription for overseas service, not opposed to participation in wars per se. This move never had majority support, even though people kept voting for the Liberal government that imposed it until 1972. And ironically, it was Whitlam who claimed an allegiance to no faith that set the prisoners free and withdrew the last Australian troops from Vietnam in 1973. In the 21st century, we have already experienced two pointless, expensive wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And if anybody ever argues to me that war actually achieves anything, I'd say, look at the last 20 years in Afghanistan, where you seem to be going back to exactly the same state you were before all those lives were lost. And what hopeless business. But what I'd like to ask you, do you think the attitude of most churches has actually changed much in the past 50 years, which is since the end of the Vietnam War? What do you reckon? Yeah, but, you know, when you read things, I mean, I went and joined the protest against Australian soldiers being sent to Iraq. One of the things that interested me was, of course, the age of protest was like me, a whole Vietnam era people. Yeah, Paul?
Yes.
Yeah, us, that's right. But I haven't heard churches speaking out against our involvement. And when a soldier gets killed in Iraq or Afghanistan, they were treated like, you know, given a state funeral in a church and all this stuff as if, you know, it's just, yeah, I find it very offensive and disappointing and totally against, I think, what we're meant to be about. But
it was very confusing to have been raised a Christian and then have your Bible in the barrel. Try to talk to parents about it. So Anglican Christianity and basically political conservatism were one and same.
I'd be interested to know how much that's changed for people. If they should, and it probably wouldn't, but if they should bring in conscription today, what the church's position would be on it?
I think at the moment the churches are happy to be moved and to just sit, you know, to state something, to be apolitical about it and not have an opinion and therefore not have to defend it.
You're not having an opinion. I mean, the idea that it's up to individual conscience, which churches have put out there, is sitting on the fence to my mind. It's not giving people any guidance. And at the same time making pronouncements about being loyal and so forth and doing your bit and not shirking and, yeah.
I don't think in terms of influencing the public, what church is saying today has anywhere near the influence.
Mm-hmm. I don't know about that, Paul. There's plenty of conservative politicians that like to ally themselves to certain churches.
Yeah, through pronouncements.
Well, I mean, I'm talking about in the First World War, they used to print the sermons, all the main sermons of the clerics in the Monday paper. You had columns of their sermons. So you don't get that anymore, thank goodness. But okay, so that's me anyway. Has anybody got any other questions?
Yeah, I was interested in your research with the conscience of defectors from Vietnam. The people who had been in a church community, did they stay with their church community, or was that a reason that you found people had left church or left faith?
A lot of them didn't leave church. They did leave their church. What interested me, because I asked a number of people what they did afterwards, was a lot of them were involved in social, you know, socially responsible work, be it peace or care or, I mean, one of the famous names of that period, Michael Matteson, who spent time in prison, he worked for prison reform afterwards. He was an anarchist. He didn't believe anything before he went into prison. But others either changed their church. One guy became a Jehovah's Witness. He said, I think that was the one that was in Kalgoorlie. He said, I came back, I was totally confused by the attitude of my church. He said, but I had never heard of the Jehovah's Witnesses serving in the army. And that attracted him because he believed, from what he understood of Jesus' teaching, that's what you Christians were not supposed to serve in the army and go to war. And the Jehovah's Witnesses stood out for him as a church that hadn't done that. Now, Jehovah's Witness position on war is an interesting one. They say if God ever calls them to war, they'll go. So they're not pacifists, but they won't go unless God calls them to war. And it's got to be a good war, you know, one that's war for the kingdom, not just empires. And when I was doing research, for the first book I did, which was the Two World Wars, there's this wonderful catalogue that I found in the National Archives in Canberra that's got this big coloured picture on it. And one is the straight way to heaven, where the Jehovah's Witnesses are going, and the other is the crooked way to evil. And on the crooked way to evil is the Pope, Hitler and Mussolini, of course, but the King of England, you know, all bunched together on the... And they, of course, it was subversive, which was why it was in the security files in the National Archives. But the shame of it was I really wanted to reproduce it in the book. And I actually wrote to the Jehovah's Witnesses in USA, and they wouldn't allow me to reproduce it. So it was a shame.
And will be on with Christian soldiers.
Yeah, but...
I went to Catholic school in Kalgoorlie, late 60s, early 70s, and we had some poetry cadets, which was probably leading to some of the army reserves. So we had sort of military training, which similar to what I was saying was happening 50 years before. So we dropped out on
the I mean, there were guys who became conscientious objectors because of the military training. And a number of cases in my present study where they were sent to Puckapunyal and told to, stick their bayonet into drums and things, and all this red fluid would flow out. And in one case where they had to shoot these drums, and the officer in charge of them turned it over, and there was a little hole in the front and a huge hole in the back, and he said, "Think what that'd do to a man's guts." And this poor guy actually was sick, and one of his fellow trainees, who was apparently a primary school teacher, turned around to him and said, "If we were both in Vietnam, I'd shoot you first before I shot the Viet Cong." So that was the kind of attitudes that they were coming up against when they went to training. Another guy was shocked because the training officer said what is patently obvious was, "You're being trained to kill." And I said, "That's what soldiers..." I don't know why it shocked him so much, because that's what soldiers do. They're trained to kill. And when they go overseas and get killed, nobody should be surprised, but, you know.
Yeah, I find that interesting, though, because, like, my dad talks about when he went to Nachos, there was a very stark dehumanisation. Like, they were trained to kill, but the people they were killing were not human. They were Viet Cong.
Oh, yeah, well, they did. That's right. They were Charlie and little yellow fellas, and they had no guts, and they had no this, and that somehow or other they managed to wage a war, but, you know, that's right. And that they were dehumanised. That was part of the... one of the comments that I had, but it was, you know, that sort of violent attitude of the use of the weapons, and even those who wanted to be non-combatants were told they had to learn to use weapons.
So how much was the scene that we're looking at? There was some people assumption that were not discussed as debatable. Yeah, but they ultimately the foundation of any debate that was happening, but it just seemed to be that any conflict to the public level was around, you know, you're either with the government or not. But there doesn't seem to be much unpacking about why people did war was a righteous activity or why people believed it was, a bad one. And alongside that, I suppose, my interest, I suppose, is around, I see Jesus as questioning or challenging the tribalist view of the world. There's our lot and that lot, and in a tribalist view, you would treat people in your tribe very well, but you could treat people outside your tribe badly. You couldn't lie to people in your tribe, but you could lie to people in the other tribe, you know, who are outside your tribe. So when we look at the history of Australia and war and the churches, how much unpacking has there been about how people thought that and why they thought that way, what the history of that thinking is?
Oh, well, there's been a lot of stuff written on why people thought the way they did about empire, which, of course, is part of the roots of it, is coming out of the idea that the British Empire was always right and that the British Empire had a better way of life, you know, and offered a better way of life to its subject peoples than anybody else, and that if the British Empire was threatened, and often, of course, it was the British Empire that started the threat, but people didn't always see it that way, you know, that we must protect that. I mean, for instance, the very idea that we treat Anzac Day the way we do, and what is Anzac Day? It's our soldiers invading someone else's country, which was no threat to us at all. So, you know, I mean, I could do another one on why I don't support Anzac Day, but seriously.
Not today,
no. But so, yeah, there is that sort of stuff, and that's the background to it. The other thing that much has been written on, of course, is Australia's xenophobia about the people to the north. And as I said to you, even by the start of the century, Japan was an ally in World War I. We never got over our fear of the Japanese. So anybody that was, Asian of appearance or colour, and of course the Vietnamese were. So, you know, you've got those two things. You've got the love of empire and you've got the xenophobic fear of Asians. You put those together, and if you have a war that involves Asia, people are more likely, I suppose, to believe that it's do or die and they have to fight it. But there are other reasons as well, I'm sure.